I'm Jack Death. I'm a trooper in the 23rd century.
Jack Death, Angel City PD. May I see your stats?
What did I do?
Under Section 7 of the Penal Code, the Council authorized me to administer you a transfer suspect examination.
You can't give me a TSE without a warrant.
I got your warrant right here now.
Okay. I don't want any trouble.
Hold on to
my job is hunting transfers.
I got nothing to hide.
Finding them.
Negative.
And singeing them.
Look out!
Of course, sometimes they find me first. Then it's a little more complicated.
How do you know Whistler's location?
We monitored a line disruption in Los Angeles, December 1985. Van Zandt, Ash, and I all had ancestors in the city then.
If you think I'm bringing that scum up the line, you got the wrong trooper.
Unless you stop Whistler, everything the Council has accomplished for the last 4 years will count for nothing.
Okay, let's say I believe this. You're a cop from the future and you're chasing this guy Piper.
Whistler.
Why doesn't he just turn you into one of these zombies? Or me?
Trancing only works on squids, people with weak minds, easily controlled. Lena, I'm from another time, another world. I don't even know what you people eat for lunch.
Okay, I got fried rice, egg rolls, and beef chow mein.
Beef? You mean like from a cow?
I thought it was rough in the 23rd century. I didn't know how hot it could get.
Jack?
How's my tan? It was getting hotter all the time.
Jack?
I guess I just attract a certain element no matter what century I'm in. I gotta run now.
I wanna ride with the lady.
Over here, Ashby!
Welcome to On Borrowed Time on the Siskoid Cinema Feed, the show that looks at time travel movies and examines the rules they go by. I'm Siskoid, and my guest on this episode with which to talk about 1984's Full Moon Entertainment release, Trancers, is the Roll Spine Podcast's Diablo Frank. Frank, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. I love this franchise. I'm looking forward to talking about it. Although I will correct you, this was an Empire Pictures film.
Yes.
It was later absorbed into Full Moon.
You're correct. When you watch it, Empire shows up, but the parts of the franchise are under Full Moon for sure. And our topic today is Trancers. It's directed by famous B-movie director, writer, and producer Charles Band, and stars Tim Thomerson and pre-stardom Helen Hunt. And this is the first of 6.3 films set in that universe. Let's just talk about where did you find this?
I saw this on basic television, UHF, the oldest channel in Houston. It's UHF 39, who thankfully they showed a lot of the same genre stuff as everybody else did, but 39 just seemed like they had a slightly higher standard. You could go into their movies with a little bit more faith that it would be something pretty good. And I believe it was 1988, and the previous year, and actually all those years were pretty bad, but especially the year prior to that. So to see this movie on TV, it was just a blast, and it was unexpected. I don't know that I had any familiarity with it before I saw it. And it was just a nice bright spot in that time period, and I just developed a real affection for it. Plus, it's just a fun movie. It's not something that was very well known. It's still not that well known. So no. You do feel like a sort of ownership to it, because there's so many more popular movies that are along the similar lines that you know there's legions of people who are going to talk about it and have a fandom for. Trancers is very niche, even for our tastes. And so to enjoy especially the first movie, but even to be able to enjoy the whole franchise like I do, it's a different kind of cat, I think, than your average. You know, you have to have a little bit more tolerance for some of the franchise's lackings, but I think that it has a lot of strengths that carry it through the movies.
I agree. I came to it roundabout a bit because I came to Full Moon and their output through... I bought an issue of a Dollman series or miniseries. And I don't mean the quality comics character. I mean Tim Thomerson as a tiny alien bounty hunter or something. And it didn't make any sense to me. So later on, when it's probably like a couple, 2-3 years ago, I decided to get into not only Dollman, but as I found out, Dollman was crossing over with these other franchises at Full Moon, Demonic Toys. And so suddenly it's like, okay, there's a whole universe of these movies are like set in the same world in a way, and they all seem to star Tim Thomerson. So I just got into the catalog, basically. Well, in that catalog was Trancers, right? And there isn't just one Trancers. There are, like I said, 6.5. There was like a movie with shorts from different Full Moon properties, including in between the first and the second movie, there's like this half hour of Where Are They Now? The Trancer characters. You know, once you start watching a couple, 2, 3, I got to get to the end. You know, I got to see number 6, basically. That's kind of how I watch movies. I thought this is pretty clever. It's kind of bonkers. Of course, it's a B-movie, but also it's got its own imagination. I mean, there's things in there that I haven't seen it remixed in this way.
One of the things that gets talked about a lot is the concept of a cinematic shared universe, which of course goes back to the Universal Monsters. And a lot of times with, you know, Marvel reigning for so many years over the cinemas, there was that parallels like, well, here's the first one and then here's this greatest manifestation of it. And there's a sense of like almost an A-B situation. But I think you have to make a point for Full Moon having a lot of the same model as Marvel ultimately had. There's a lot of film critics that treat Marvel as though it's a TV show, like a huge budget TV show where you're watching episode after episode of this ongoing narrative, right?
Right.
And to a large degree, Full Moon was already doing that. Obviously, they didn't have Marvel's resources, but there was a sense of the same people working on similar projects, and there was those overlaps. Also, Malibu was licensing most of the Full Moon properties, and so you had the comic book tie-in to the movies, and obviously there's a strong comic book influence on the movies, so you can see a lot of that Marvel model in place in Full Moon. It's not as fully realized, but you get a sense of there might be some influence on what became Marvel in the Full Moon properties.
That's possible. I mean, this is the kind of thing that it's less episodic. It's not really episodic. I guess the Trancers, you know, itself, like any movie franchise, there's an episodic nature to it. But when it crosses over with the other properties, it's just a goofy crossover thing, you know, it almost doesn't make sense.
Well, and again, I do see it as a bridge because there's a lot of the Universal Monsters kind of stuff with regards to Full Moon, besides the fact that they mostly do horror properties. But also there was a sort of let's just do it and figure out the details later situation. It very much falls on the Dick Giordano, Jerry Conway side of this sort of concept versus the Jim Shooter side of it.
And as you'll see, I'll give a quick synopsis. We can talk about the movie particulars afterwards, just to give people a broad notion of it and then tell them, you know, go and watch it. I think it's on Tubi, you know, everybody gets that. So
Freeview and Amazon Prime both have the Full Moon properties. So you can see those for free with commercials.
The quick synopsis, as you'll see, sounds like another movie that came out in 1984 in some way, but I don't think it owes all that much to it. Angel City Trooper Jack Death is sent back in time from 2247 to 1985 LA to inhabit the body of his ancestor. Death's assignment is to find his archenemy Whistler, who turns people into zombies before the fiend is able to kill all the ancestors of the future's governing council. So obviously this sounds like Terminator. But if it came out the same year as Terminator, how quick was the turnaround, which is quite possible for these kinds of movies? But at the same time, it's like, it almost seems like Charles Band was working off of a newspaper copy about, you know, an announcement for this film rather than the film itself. Because I don't know if you felt the same thing, but I felt like the urtext to this, the main inspiration, was really Blade Runner.
That's absolutely the case. And actually, probably one of the reasons why I like Trancers so much is I saw it before Blade Runner. So I wasn't aware of the derivation there. But yeah, a lot of people make a big deal about the Terminator thing. And I really feel like it's a Mandela effect because I just don't see any way timeline wise that Terminator would have had any impact on this movie, because they were filmed pretty much around the same time. They were released a week apart from one another. And who was Jim Cameron in 1984 anyway? He was the guy who directed Piranha 2: The Spawning. So there's no reason why anybody would think that the Terminator was going to be anything but a B-movie at the same level as Trancers, right? In fact, maybe even to some degree less so, because I think this was a top priority movie for Empire, and I think it's a pretty low priority movie for was it Orion that put out Terminator?
You would know. I mean,
yeah,
I know you deal with Terminator comics rather than the films themselves, but you would be the expert here,
right? Well, I don't want to claim quite that much expertise, more so the comic books right now. I have yet to rewatch Terminator since I've been doing the podcast, so there's definitely a vulnerability there. But I think that is so obvious that this thing is taking from really the voiceover edit of Blade Runner 2, and it's giving it a more of a Mickey Spillane vibe. It's got the same neon lit qualities. It's just a really low budget take on Blade Runner, but also the simple fact is Terminator didn't exist in a vacuum. You know, obviously Harlan Ellison successfully sued for credits on the Terminator movie, which I don't think he really earned. I think they're all borrowing from a similar pool of influences that dated back before he was a professional. And so who's to say that they just didn't have the same influences and they're coming out around the same time? It's just the zeitgeist at some point, you know, because they're not similar enough for me to believe that one had anything to do with the other. I think that they exist independent of one another. But as you say, Blade Runner is really the prototype for Trancers, and then the model upon which much of this movie is built upon.
Definitely, it's a noir. I mean, they kind of lose that in the franchise after a couple of films, but it's really a noir. But the McNulty character, it's kind of the James Olmos.
Yeah, or the Emmett Walsh, I would say. He's a little bit more like the Chief to some degree as well, where he's just trying to demand that he's going to get his way and pull whatever fascistic stuff he has to get his trooper to do what he needs him to do.
Jack Death's car in the future was heavily modified by Gene Winfield, who built the spinners and full-size cars in Blade Runner. So there's a real connection.
Yeah, the synth theme is very Tangerine Dream. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of parallels there. The aesthetic, the suits. And I got to say, too, that's one of the reasons why I love Trancers, is something that I've grown to love in any genre is the whole cynical voiceover, which of course goes back to noir, goes back to Humphrey Bogart. Bogart was a huge influence on Thomerson's performance and in the writing of the movie. And then I see this in other fictions. One of my favorite comic books of all time is Grimjack, which is essentially the exact same thing. It's a pulp detective in a sci-fi future fantasy setting. So Trancers got there first for me, which is part of the reason why I love it so much. But it's also a part of a approach to genre storytelling that just resonates with me. I like it when my lead character sort of kind of talks to me directly through the narration. It makes me bond with them more than the more isolating approach of, say, the director's cut of Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. I know people hate the voiceover. Harrison Ford obviously did it under protest and as monotonally as possible. I still dig it. It's still my preferred version. I'm sorry.
It's not my preferred version, but I do enjoy it in a camp kind of way, which is the same way that I enjoy Trancers, quite frankly, because I would say that the film doesn't take itself very seriously. And that's, I think, my sweet spot when it comes to B-movies, that they kind of know what they're doing there, that it's that there are some silly things. Like, he's called Jack Death, and like at some point in the movie, he's watching Peter Gunn on TV. And he says, "What kind of a name is Peter Gunn?" And Helen Hunt says, "What kind of a name is Jack Death?"
Right.
You know, so it knows, like Charles Band knows that this material is inherently silly. Like all genre has like a silliness, because once you decode the tropes, it's kind of creaky in a way. But knowing this and then playing off of it, it's part of the fun. I think it makes you complicit in the kind of goofiness that comes with it. So the fact that, you know, like sushi, cold fish, which is the Blade Runner line that I often use. So I quote that speech, even though my preferred version is the director's cut, you know.
Well, and there's a thing too, where we've been reckoning with how human beings treat human beings a lot in the last 10 years, 20 years. And you've got a great filmmaker like Stanley Kubrick, who essentially tortures his actors. And you've got actors that arguably were permanently traumatized by appearing in his movies. And then there's the argument of, is the movie so great that it's worth it, that it damaged these human beings permanently, potentially? And one of the great things about a movie like Trancers is, you know, that that's not the case here. The reason why you enjoy this movie in part is because you can tell that everybody who's performing in it is having a great time. Nobody is showing up the way they are for transfers on its budget with its what it has to work with. They're doing it because they're enjoying each other and they're enjoying the spotlight. They're having fun, and so that's infectious, and you can feel good about watching this movie without having to second guess, you know, what these people had to go through to make it. Obviously, they were just having a blast.
Yeah, and if it is similar to Terminator, it's only the plot going back in time to stop, you know, a villain that has also gone back in time before they change the future, essentially, or change their present. It kind of stops there. Because, well, there are like killer machine characters. So instead of Terminators, instead of robots, it's like this guy, Whistler, is controlling transfers. So whatever the process of the transfers is, which I think is explored in like the third film, I think more fully, but here it's just like, it just seems like he hypnotizes people. He puts them under his mental control because it only works on people with a weak willpower. Won't work on Helen Hunt, for example. And they sort of become like Manchurian candidates. When they see Jack Death, they try to kill him very violently. They lose all sense of themselves under Whistler's control, even remotely. And then when they're done with their mission or they fail at their mission, they're vaporized. They heat up and all that is left is a scorch mark. Am I describing it correctly?
I think that's fair, but also it's tricky because you've got this expansive franchise and they definitely lose the thread on what exactly a transfer is. I think mm-hmm. it's very debatable. In fact, when I read some of the comic books, they go into full zombie mode by the time they get to the last of the comics. And that very much frustrated me. You wouldn't think because I'm such a zombie fan, but I like, you know, transfers is such a unique concept that I enjoy your version of that, your interpretation of that more. I like to think that what happens is besides being essentially cultists and sort of like junkie slaves of Whistler, they also maybe reach a hypermetabolic state where they have resources of strength and energy that normal humans don't have, which is why the elderly woman in the diner at the beginning of the movie is able to tackle a hardened cop like Jack Death. But of course, she can only do that for so long. And I still don't know if it's that she burns out or it's just that his heater, the particular device that he has in the movie, does that for them. But then again, he used a regular gun once he's in the modern times. So it must be that that hyperbolic state just causes a meltdown and they literally get singed and leave a burn mark. And that's how you know that they were a transfer versus a regular human that just got shot.
Right. They spontaneously combust due to that expenditure of energy. Let's say that's what's going on.
Well, in this movie, I think we can say that. Later movies, I think there's a lot more debate to be had.
Right. They kind of change it up. And also there's like after Whistler, there are other transfer makers, so maybe there's like different processes and that makes it different, you know, like that technology, quote unquote, is evolving, which could explain what's happening in other films. You know, replace the robots, the killer robots with these, I'm calling them zombies, they're not really zombies, you know, but switch them out for these zombies and it's kind of the same. Once you're back in the past, Whistler, etc., are trying to kill the ancestors of the ruling council, which makes them disappear. This is kind of like Looper, if you've seen Looper, where you realize that suddenly you've vanished and you have not been replaced by someone else in the history. Let's talk about a little bit about that, the whole time travel element here. What do you think of these temporal physics?
So here's the thing. I love the concept of sending people down the line. And I love all the different quirky terms that come up with for this franchise to describe what they've got going on. Sometimes you have to reach beyond the movies. The comic books call it temporal transmigration, which is a bit of a mouthful. But I like that you've got your pseudoscientific version as well as the up and down the line part of it. I think mm-hmm. that the whole idea of sending your mind backwards into an ancestor and the complications that come from that are great. And I think that the franchise would have been a bit stronger and probably better received if it actually played out the implications of that more. But instead, there's a lot of magical thinking with this franchise where once they've got Jack Death from the future to the past, they don't really want to have to worry about the details anymore. So it's just, okay, this is where we're at, and we're just going to go forward from that. But I do think it's really novel. And again, you're talking about how, well, supposedly something like Terminator was supposed to influence transfers, but transfers maybe influence Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other franchise with its own little audience that probably often have no idea that transfers even exists and predated it.
Yeah, this is like at least a few years before Quantum Leap, and it's just your own ancestor, but it's still the same idea. You're time traveling only mentally, and your body's on a table in a waiting room somewhere, and if that body dies, that's and I love that scene.
Well, and also it's important too, because you can only send a person down the line where you know they have an ancestor. You can't just do it blind, because if you do it blind, there's no way to bring them back forward again. So you've that limitation, so they're not going to, you know, ancient times or something. And Quantum Leap, he can only leap within his own timeline, his time and existence on the temporal plane from when he was born to when he dies. That's the area in which he can jump, and that's the limitation. And with time, it's so tricky, because you could go back to the dinosaurs potentially, and then you have a whole bunch of that opens up a whole can of worms. I like how they create that fence around itself, where it's a cool concept, but we'll only take it so far by design.
Right. You need to have the, you know, historical records to know where these ancestors are. And you could potentially go back further than the 1980s, obviously. We lived in the 1980s when the movie came out, so it just made sense to make it contemporary, you know, with the world that was going to watch the movie. And it allows for things like Jack Death goes back into his ancestor, and his ancestor looks exactly like him. Fine. Of course, you want Tim Thomerson in the movie from, you know, start to finish. But McNulty, when he goes back, he's in this little girl, which, and through the franchise, we see that little girl grow up.
I love how they go back to the same actress. I love that continuity. And it's actually just kind of neat, because you see the little, 9 or 10-year-old girl, and then she's a 16-year-old girl. And McNulty even comments on how, you're going to send me back, and now I'm a teenager. Everybody's going to want to get in my pants. That's the kind of thing that makes this a fun franchise, is that very human reaction to this extraordinary circumstance. And you connect to it that much more when you actually see with your own eyeballs, these are the same people showing up again and again for these movies.
And they did the same when they tried to resurrect the franchise with the sixth one. They just reused scenes from earlier films where Jack Death is sent back. These are old shots. And then this time it's like he's going in, like in the 2000s or whatever. He's inside another ancestor, like this character's daughter, basically. And now he's a woman. But he's being played not by Tim Thomerson, but by a female actress who's trying to do Jack Death. It's not the best of the franchise for sure, but it's the same kind of idea that they did with McNulty here. You know, conversely, if you look at the villain here, Whistler, he sends himself back into his ancestor, who is a police lieutenant or a police detective. Not only is Jack Death trying to track down this guy, but he's got the authorities on his side. And he's turning cops, and he's making his own army of trancers in the present. That idea, what happened in T2? Oh, that's right. The Terminator was posing as a cop. I don't know who sees what or what, you know, what's a coincidence and who saw what, but it just seems to all be connected.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of face-off in there too, where the cop becomes the crook and the crook becomes the cop. Mm-hmm. And their positions in society are reversed, and that causes complications. So it's pretty cool. And you can see it translating, you know, various places. I seriously doubt that face-off is influenced by Trancers, but Trancers did kind of get there first.
Yeah, I mean, and it's probably there's other movies or TV shows that did things like this, you know. Not everything goes back to Trancers, but at the same time, it's like Trancers was a little ahead of the game. We can say that.
And mostly we want to reinforce that just because it's often dismissed as a knockoff. And worse, it's a knockoff of the wrong movie that it couldn't have possibly been a knockoff of. So it all gets kind of muddy. And so as a fan of the franchise, you want to kind of clear the air a little bit.
And if you're wondering if Trancers is for you, it's also a Christmas movie. So if you're looking for those action movies that are also Christmas movies, you know, you don't Die Hard every year, you might think about Trancers.
And it is, of course, Christmas in Southern California, so with all that entails.
So was Die Hard.
Exactly. It's like, you're not going to see any snow or anything, but very important Santa Claus moment in this movie.
Not only that, you got Ellen Hunt in a Santa costume. She works in a mall, you know, with a mall Santa. And the mall Santa is a Trancer, and you're going to have a fight with the Santa Claus and Jack Death, you know. Definitely. It is a Christmas movie. It's got enough Christmas action.
And you're getting Helen Hunt in an elf costume, so that's a win.
Even at the fight, because there are a couple of moments in here I felt like, you know, this is pretty imaginative for a B-movie. You know, it's not just the standard shoot 'em up, boring, same action you see in everything, the same car chase, the same rat-tat-tat, Uzis going off. That's not what this is. So the fight with the Santa Claus, for example, it ends with Santa Claus being, I think it's on Jack Death first, but there are these antlers. I guess in the mall, you can buy some antlers and moose heads, or not sure what that display is doing.
I think it was part of the decoration for Santa's workshop.
Okay, so it's supposed to be like reindeer, right? So, and he gets stabbed with the reindeer antlers. So you've got like that piece of it. And again, very Christmassy.
There's some great Christmas-themed gags in there where if it was trying to play it straight, it would have been kind of flat. But because you're getting some chuckles and you're getting a little bit of a Christmas story in the midst of your Die Hard, it just makes all the difference in your enjoyment of what you're seeing.
Right. Like the lady who calls for security is like trouble at the North Pole and, you know, stuff like that. It's fun. And later on, there's another imaginative scene I felt or attempt at death when he does track down that first ancestor that he's supposed to save. The guy is like this surfer dude who runs a suntan thing, and the guy has been tranced. We don't know this, but he's been tranced, and he turns on Jack Death and he locks him up in a suntanning booth, which is like burning him. And so like the death he's prepared for Jack Death could possibly be gruesome, but it is imaginative. And that's what I mean. Like this movie isn't just like replaying the old tropes and the easy stunts. And it tries to do different things.
Well, and it's funny too, that obviously Jack Death is very dismissive of the surfer dude and thinks he's a squid head and everything. But the truth is Tim Thomerson actually got a start as a professional surfer. So he had more in common with that guy than he does with Jack Death.
I didn't know that. What do you think generally of Helen Hunt in these movies? She's the Sarah Connor. Of course, she's not, but...
Well, it's funny because in the later installments, they do have an actress who's sort of trying to do a Sarah Connor thing, and they're very open about that. The third movie is intentionally riffing on the Terminator franchise, so just get that out of the way. Helen Hunt is part of what makes this franchise, especially the first entry, so great, because she is just an extraordinary actress. And she so fully inhabits that character, even though she's supposed to be playing a punk rock girl, which she does not pull off. But her presence is so strong and her chemistry with Tim Thomerson is so great. It's a little weird because they've got a romantic relationship in this movie where he'd played his niece in a TV show about a decade earlier when she was really getting her start. But yeah, she's so wonderful in these movies. And every time she appears in the movie, she's in the first 3.25 or whatever you want to call it. Every scene that she's in elevates the material. So it's just extraordinary to have gotten her at that moment in time where she has the craft to be so good in the role, and she's actually willing to do Empire or Full Moon movies because she has an affection for these characters, and also she's a family friend of Charles Band. But I love that she keeps showing up even when she's really, you know, priced out of their reach, but she just has a dedication to it. And she's just wonderful. And I honestly think she's one of the best actresses that we have. I loved her on Mad About You as well. So I have a great affection for her, and she's wonderful in these movies.
I think so too. I you know, she's in that first one. She's in the 0.5 City of Lost Angels. And then in the second movie, and we're not really going down into that, you know, talking about the whole franchise in any kind of detail. But in the second movie, one thing that we learned in the first one is that the reason Jack Death is so obsessed with killing Whistler and killing Trancers, it's not just professional for him, is that they killed his wife.
It's much more pronounced when the wife shows up in modern times and he has to question whether or not he can save this woman that he loves, that he knows is doomed.
Of course, that makes Helen Hunt's character kind of on the outs in a way. And then in the third one, she's barely in it, you know, like a day's work, probably her farewell. But after that, I think, you know, by the third one, Charles Band isn't even directing it anymore. So, and she's on Mad About You. So.
Well, it literally, the third one comes out a month after Mad About You starts.
Yeah.
So she was obviously filming Mad About You by the time the third movie came out. But I think that took her to another level. She'd done a number of movies. She'd gotten some good notices. But I don't think she was a proper star until Mad About You became a hit.
No.
So again, that lightning in a bottle, getting her at just that right time. But the fact is, she could have just easily dismissed the franchise, let somebody else play her role. But she just couldn't let it go. She wanted to put a little cap on her time with the franchise. And she even has a tiny little moment in the sixth movie. She's not actually there. Is another one of those things where they were shimping her. Her presence remains throughout the series. And so it's nice that they don't, it's weird because they suck at continuity and they counter their own continuity so much in these movies. But in terms of like the family part of it, where everybody who's been in these movies is part of the family, they never seem to forget their family members. And what's nice too with the second movie is that they create the conflict that allows her to ultimately exit the franchise. But by the end of that movie, it's actually a happy ending and you don't really know where things are going to go. It could actually be the last movie the way they set things up. And then three, they explain, well, I guess it wasn't a happy ending after all, but they give her the opportunity to have those few scenes where you understand the arc.
After that, the franchise goes a little weird. It becomes like Army of Darkness or something, you know, like Trancers in a D&D kind of world.
Well, I mean, literally, like, the third movie is a knockoff of Terminator. The fourth and fifth movies are clearly inspired by Army of Darkness. I suspect that somebody had access to a foreign castle, and that's the whole reason why they did that for those two movies. But not only are they clearly drawing influence from Army of Darkness, but the simple fact is that the Jack Death character from the very beginning has same DNA as Ash Williams from that franchise, as Jack Burton from Big Trouble in Little China. If you like that kind of swaggering macho type, he's absolutely in the same club.
Yes, definitely, because it's not just the swaggering macho persona, it's that they're kind of shit at it. Mm-hmm. You know, as heroes, they're kind of shit. All of them. You know, Jack Death is always forgetting stuff. He's losing the pictures that he has to bring. And he's losing, you know, he loses his watch that has a time slowing element. So he's not very good at the things that he's supposed to be really good at. And I think that's true of Ash. It's true of Jack Burton.
Well, and it gets back to Rick Deckard in Blade Runner too, is Jack gets manhandled quite a bit in these movies. And the fact is, in the first movie, he's 38, and then he does it for another decade. So he's pushing 50 by the end of his time. Much like Bill Shatner on Star Trek, depending on where you are in the franchise, his gut's going to get bigger and bigger, and the coat's going to have to cover him up more and more. He's much less and less likely to show up with his shirt off. And you see the age accumulating on this guy. And they try to compensate for that some. They make him a little bit more of a tough guy in the later installments. But you can see that this is a near 50-year-old man trying to run up hills, and it takes a toll. And so especially as I get older, I can definitely relate more to where Jack Death is in this franchise than I can to, you know, the Superman. And, like, again, the opposite trajectory for Bruce Willis in the Die Hard franchise, where he gets more and more competent and more superhuman, which is, you know, an exact opposition to what you liked about the character in the first movie. And I like that Jack, for the most part, leans into, I'm getting old for this shit. You know, he's that guy.
He's already there, right? He's miscounting shots. He doesn't get the girl in the first movie. Every time there's like about to be a sex scene or something, like he gets snapped back or something. It's not a concern later, but it seems to maybe be an unspoken concern in the first film that he can't really bang his great 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 grandmother.
They sure got over that by the second one, though.
He's the father of his own great great grandmother, whichever, you know. So. No, it's not a problem later, but
he falls into a Fry hole for sure.
It's Fry in the Futurama. This is the kind of question that I'm always asking of these characters. It's like, well, if they die and if they're tranced, bam, they're dead already, right? So there's a lot of jeopardy about surviving in the future because your ancestors are extremely vulnerable to Whistler or whoever is making trancers, because they can just like turn them into trancers. They don't even have to kill them. By the end here, there's only one council member left. But one question that I did have is the other ancestor they have to save, who is part of this family, who reappears in other movies, Ashby, the failed baseball player and whatever. He's now a hobo, he's not a bum. And I felt like this is the luckiest hobo on the face of the planet, because mm-hmm. he's already kind of old. He lives on the streets, continually drunk, and that was also true of the actor, apparently. You know, it hasn't happened yet. He's still fated to have a child who will spawn this council member eventually.
Yeah, and, you know, we return to him 6 years later for the first of the sequels, and he's still, like you said, he hasn't had the baby yet, plus he falls off the wagon and puts on his baseball uniform again, preparing for his death by trancer. And going all the way up to the third movie, they're still referencing that character. He's still a beneficiary of a character who appears in that movie. And that being sideways, he's got a connection to the sixth movie. So again, this is a character who would have easily been forgotten about in any other franchise, but this guy continues to haunt this entire franchise. And it's nice that they don't throw that guy away. Now, the problem is, in the second movie, you kind of wish they'd thrown him away, because one of the things that really hurts the second movie is their need to bring everybody back and try to figure out something for them to do. And they don't always have interesting things to do. And a lot of it does feel tacked on. But in the first movie, that actor is exceptional. And what's funny is, like you said, he was having trouble, alcohol problems. He was a friend of Tim Thomerson's, who was a fellow stand-up comic. And when you see him getting manhandled in that movie, that's really happening, because right. he's drunk on the set and he's not being able to deliver lines or get where he needs to be. And so when you're seeing Jack, you know, push him around and get him to where he needs to be to keep the story going forward, he's really doing that in real life. And it just gives you that extra level of realism and that recognition that these guys are dealing with the stuff that you think they're dealing with. You're part of this situation. You know, they're making the best of the situation.
But they do save him. So, you know, at least there's one councilman. Because the wacky thing here, well, there are two wacky things for me in the movie. One is that everybody takes everything at face value, you know, especially the Helen Hunt's character. Once she sees the Trancer Santa, okay, I guess this is what's happening. Oh, you come from the future? I guess that's true. You know, there's none of that wasting time with arguing about what's true, what's not, etc., which I don't want to see. I don't care about that stuff anyways.
But they do kind of address that, because when she's just needing a ride to work at first, then she sees Santa get singed and she's taken hostage by Jack Death. He needs help to get to Cahuenga Boulevard and he's expecting her to help him get there. She abandons him, and that's when he falls into the trap in the tanning booth, and she's the one who ends up saving him because she has the time to think it through, and she comes to the conclusion that she's going with her gut. She actually believes this guy, and she knows it's stupid and she knows it's a bad move on her part, but she accepts what she's seen with her eyes and what she feels in her intuition. So that character gets to have that arc where she figures her stuff out and she ends up in a place where she's going to buy in. And of course Helen Hunt can completely sell it. She's a great actress, but also you actually get to see that happening without having to actually watch every agonizing minute and cutting back to her over and over again. It's just Jack's in a trap, Jack's out of the trap. It's explained because she decided to go ahead and go along with what he's saying.
Did you get ambushed at that point as well, right? And this is one element that we haven't really talked about is, up the line, there's a lot of time travel technology. Because even when they tell him Whistler has gone down the line, it's like, oh, no. Like, this is just a thing that can happen. There's time travel technology. It's just out there and maybe it can get into the wrong hands. It's not even a surprise. It's quantum leaping into the head of your ancestor, but you can also send objects. You can send guns, you can send photos, you can send this watch, which also uses a different kind of temporal thing where it elongates a second into 10 seconds, which actually takes like 30, 40 seconds, but it doesn't matter. Don't count. It slows down time for anyone but the person, so you can escape bullets and that kind of thing. But they did play it well. I think when they jump into that car, he doesn't start the car until time resumes. They don't mention this, but it makes complete sense to me that like the chemical reaction and the ignition and the motor working would all have been slowed down anyways. So his car could not have gone fast in any case. So the car only takes off once the effect is over, which I thought, well, it made me think, yes, it's kind of ridiculous and they're throwing everything at the wall. But at the same time, they've thought about this. You know, there's an internal logic that I believe.
Well, again, it's that Mandela effect. Is they never tell you at any point in this franchise that they cannot send organic matter backwards in time. But you saw Terminator a few months before this, probably, especially since most people saw it on video or on television. You're filling in that detail that's never mentioned in the movie. But it's the only thing that makes sense. Is like, okay, you can send the gun back in time. You can send the watch back in time. The other thing, though, is you were talking about in Back to the Future episode how these people will try to no prize Back to the Future and point out flaws in it and stuff. Mm. And you called BS on that. And I have to do the same. It drives me nuts when people talk about how it's supposed to be 10 seconds, but it runs for like a minute. It's like, yeah, but you're watching him run in slow motion. So just like if you're watching a Zack Snyder movie, it's not like the world suddenly stops and everything freeze frames. No, they're still moving at full speed. It's the movie is slowing down to show you the actions. The same thing's happening here. It is 10 seconds, like I tell you, but you're seeing everybody move in slow motion. You know, you're seeing right. bullets fly through the air. They're doing that for your benefit, audience member. You're not supposed to sit there with your watch, you moron.
Right. There's the effect of the watch, and then there's the effect of overcranking the camera, which is additional to that.
But also, it reminds me of something else that bring up, probably because it's even more obscure movie today than Trancers, but more so back if you were watching television in the 80s. They had a 1980 TV movie called The Girl, the Gold Watch and Everything with the guy from Airplane, Robert Shaw. No, not Robert Shaw. Robert Stack. No? What is his name?
You mean the guy that was also the TV Starman?
Exactly, the TV Starman. Robert Hays.
Yeah.
So it had Robert Hays and Pam Dolber from Mork and Mindy. And it was an adaptation of like a 1960 or 63 book. So Harlan Ellison can't claim credit to that. But the whole thing is about a guy who has a pocket watch. And when he clicks it, he gets like a minute of frozen time, which I know is a whole subgenre on Pornhub at this point, but back then was pretty novel. And so this is an instance where clearly Transfers is borrowing from this TV movie from 4 years earlier that was based on a book from decades earlier. But nobody remembers that movie anymore. Nobody remembers that book anymore. So it lives on through Transfers.
And I mean, it's another fun element. And I believe also that the you can send objects down the line through a different means, which probably just means that, you know, if you send a person, it would kill them. So we can only send the brainwaves. And we sort of went in another direction when I was talking about earlier, but I do want to restate that scene where Jack Death is told, you're going to go down the line. They already have Whistler's body there. You know, they recovered his body and they want him to stand trial. So we need you to, like the way you return to the future is that they stick you with a drug that shocks your system and sends you out and back up the line. And so we want you to give this to Whistler so that he comes back up the line and he can stand trial for his crimes. And Jack Death is like, I'm not having any of that. And he shoots the body right there.
That very much establishes his having an antagonistic relationship with the council, which is great because every movie is about him not respecting other people's authority and doing, you know, he's the renegade cop, the classic renegade cop. But what's great too is it specifically gets him in Dutch with Richard Hurd, who everybody will know from V. And again, as a nerd boy from the 80s, it's like, yeah, it's the guy from V. So you're kind of getting off on the main visitor fighting our new hero, Jack Death, as a result of their differences of opinion. You also get the whole Dirty Harry thing where it's like, City Hall, huh? I'm not going to do it their way. I'm going to do it my way.
He drops his badge in the first 10 minutes, you know? and there's just some nice world building as well for the future. You know, like you do see that LA has been flooded. It's just ruins underwater. And he's still going out there trying to find objects that remind him of his wife or, you know, stuff like that. So there's like this whole, these are bits that they could have just skipped because you want to get to the 1985s. Quickly as possible, probably, but they're still building that world. We understand that in the future, things have changed. And so he can relate back to, you know, when he's in 1985, there's a reason he's sort of a fish out of water, which is almost a pun there. Like this movie is really well constructed, regardless of its means. I mean, in terms of production value, you'd be surprised how much production value you can add just by making the lights red, which is kind of what they do in the Chinatown sequences, the Chinatown apartment and the dance club. Just using a different lighting makes it more luscious. I don't know.
The opening sequence in the diner, they're using those same red lights to create this mood, this horror vibe and this enhanced reality there. And that was some diner out in the middle of somewhere in California that they just redressed to make it look more futuristic. But they pulled it off. Great job, guys. I got to say, too, that very much like the people who saw Terminator and wanted to see a movie that takes place during the Machine War and not so much the stuff that's happening in 91 or 84, I do wish there'd been more Transfers material set in his time period, because I love that aesthetic. I love the outfits. You talked earlier about how, yeah, it's still Tim Thomerson playing Jack Death in the future and Philip Death in the past. But when he's Jack Death in the future, he's got his hair slicked intensely backwards. It's black. His eyebrows are busher. He's got the scar and he's got those fantastic suits, which kills me because they don't ever have him wear those suits again. And they look so cool. I want to see that future fashion in some of the other movies and it never shows up again.
It's kind of too bad, yeah, that they went with the Dungeons and Dragons stuff. You know, the Hercules legendary journeys or whatever. because yeah, they could have set more things in the 23rd century, alas. And that diner scene that you're mentioning does have a legacy. It you know, there's a music video by The Neighborhood, Scary Love, which is an homage to the scene. They've got like a Jack Death character played by Tommy Wiseau. and it's kind of by way of Terminator because they're doing like the POVs are machine-like, or they're like the Terminator ones. He's wearing Arnold's clothes, not really Jack Death's clothes, stuff like that. But the Trancer does heat up and disintegrate at the end. So it's clearly, you know, an homage to Trancers. So there are a lot of people have seen this movie and incorporated it in other things. I think if we come away with anything out of this conversation, is how much influence it seems to have had up the line and not so much down the line, taken down the line. And then when we do get to Whistler at the end, like I said, he doesn't have a body up the line. In other words, what does he say? Like, you're going up the line, no stops or something. It's a great kill line, you know, because then like the stakes for the villain is that when he gets poked with the drug, he's got nowhere to go. There is a morality here because like it would have been easy to kill Lieutenant Whistler, whatever the character's name, you know, the cop. Mm-hmm. And then, well, then Whistler never exists. But no, it's like, I'm going to poke you with this. Your soul is going to go right out of your body and to nothing. And the cop just standing there like, where am I? You know, kind of thing. So they don't kill the present day person, which you'd think like Jack Death, if he were like really a Judge Dredd type character, that wouldn't have mattered.
Yeah, there's clearly a lot of thought put into that because the trancers, once you become a trancer, you can't come from that, back from that. And they're tend to be weaker people anyway. And obviously, I don't want to go into the ethics, the morals of that concept. But these are people that are done once they become trancers. So there's really nothing you can do for them. You can't help them. It's, again, very much like the zombie thing that you've been bit. You're going to die. Right. I can't save you. The people whose bodies are being inhabited by people who've gone down the line, these are innocent people. They don't have any control over any of these actions that are taking place. So it's not fair to them to punish them for crimes they didn't commit. It's a Minority Report kind of situation, more so, in fact, because they're completely innocent of at least of what the people who are inhabiting their bodies would be accused of. So it is nice that they think about that in this movie. And I think that's an impact on Bilson and Amiyo, the guys who would go on to do the Flash TV show and do the Rocketeer. Good writers who bring that joyful quality to this effort, where I think some of the other people sort of forget the human qualities of the first movie and they get too much into the violence and it loses something. I think that the franchise is better when they're thinking about the people whose bodies they're inhabiting and giving that some consideration.
Yeah. I think it plays with the same elements of doesn't take itself too seriously. You know, it's like, yes, he's supposed to be like a Punisher kind of guy, but there's a limit to that. There, you know, it doesn't go into territory that you find maybe distasteful. Going on a ride and there's just enough humor, just enough action, just enough Ellen Hunt to make you just accept it. No, well, really, it helps accept this whole premise. Okay, let's go to final summation then, because I like to give a score on these, you know, basically between 0 and 12. Rather than a 10 scale, because it's like a clock. So the clock score is midnight is the worst possible and high noon is the best possible. So how would you rate Trancers as a movie? Where is it on your clock?
I have a lot of personal affection, but I'm going to try to be at least somewhat objective on this. I'm going to give it about a 7:30. Because I think that a layperson can go into this thing, even if they're not a genre person, even if they don't have any intention to carry on with the franchise. The writing on this is good enough, and really the cast is so good because we haven't talked very much. Art LaFleur as McNulty is so awesome. He's such one of those like classic character actors that elevates the material just by his presence and his commitment to the role. You got Thelma Hopkins, who's going to go on to be in Family Matters. She's great in the flick. She has a great rapport with Jack Death. In one of the later movies, it finds out that they were once romantically linked, which is a nice little progressive element given that this is a 1984 franchise. You've got Anne Seymour as the surviving council member. What a wonderful voice. She absolutely, if you're going to only have one person survive to run the world, I think Anne Seymour is the one you go with. Obviously, the Trancers, most of those guys are barely above extras, but they definitely give it their all. And so you've got such a great like community theater. We're putting on a show quality to this movie that I think just a regular person can watch this and get a 7.5, 7:30 out of this. I would maybe go a little higher in my heart, but we're probably talking to uninitiated here. I want them to go in there with realistic expectations.
I think I'm going to go with the same score. I might even go to an 8 because my own personal tastes are basically, have I seen this before? And I have not seen this before, regardless, you know. And we're talking about a B-movie that seems to be a ripoff of something. And it does have like that Blade Runner vibe, which is not necessarily ripped off, but, you know, comes from another source, which happens to be one of my favorite movies ever. So yeah. There's no...
Well, and also you had to wait like 40 years for an actual sequel. And really, when you think about it, well, there are obviously a billion movies that were influenced by Blade Runner, and Blade Runner itself was influenced by Jodorowsky's Dune production.
Yeah.
There's not a very many movies that really nail it. And I'm not saying Trancers nails it, But for such a cheap little movie, it comes an awful lot closer than some really well-intended, well-funded attempts that come along later on.
Sometimes a B-movie can just hit it out of the park in a way that the stakes aren't the same. It will surprise you. This is the kind of thing you think, okay, now this is just going to be direct-to-video 80s fare. But it's better than that. And has some you know, pretty great stars as well. So yeah, I'm pushing for the 8, but I accept the 7:30 as quite a possible
7:45. We can go
7:45.
You know, you've got your convention has a lot of leeway to it. If we want to go 7:40, 7:35, we can get it. We can inch it up a little bit. But we can give it a long second. You know,
7:59. But what about the time travel mechanics in this film? It's a little bit of everything. I'm curious as to where you would place this.
So here's the thing. Like I said, I love the idea of sending people down the line. I love the long second. It's just that I wish that a little bit more thought had been put into the consequences of these technologies. I wish it had played out more. And especially as you got looking at it from a full franchise view, they really don't explore this very well over the course of the franchise. They'd have had a lot better movies if they had. So I'm only going to give it a 3 o'clock. I think that the germ of the idea is great, but there's some problems with the execution. And as of course, since Quantum Leap does a much better job with this concept than Transfers ultimately does. So it's going to have to take the hit on this area. I'm going to take the time from the overall judgment of the movie, running it up to an 8, and it's going to have to come out of the time that goes into the mechanics.
I'm going to go a little later. Higher, so later. I'm almost at a 4 a.m.
We're kind of splitting hairs.
But in the sense that I agree with everything you've said, but also the fact that it's kind of gets there first in terms of quantum leaping kind of gives it a certain edge. They don't explain it, but also it makes sense to a person trying to figure it out and trying to put words to it. So that's good. But the bit that doesn't make sense, the fact that it doesn't get to a sunrise, basically, is that it's like Looper where, you know, oh, well, this person vanished right in front of my eyes. Okay, wait, is history changed or does it just affect a single person? And how can that be, right?
Yeah, well, and that's something we didn't talk about. And I think we need to.
Go ahead.
One thing I have to say to take away from the minutes is we do have to discuss glowing red boxes that just materialize with no explanation, mm-hmm. especially when you set up, here's a watch. You can only do this long second thing one time. Oh, you did it? Okay, well, here's another watch. You know, yeah. That's okay, come on, guys. Magical thinking again. But also, you talked a lot in the Back to the Future episode about the elasticity of time. And I just don't think time can work the same way in the Transfers universe. I don't even think it's a delayed reaction. I think it's some sort of a weird thing where they exist in a different state of time to where you can retroactively kill a member of the council, but everybody continues to remember that member of the council and what impact they had. And it just doesn't, it's not even a temporal paradox. It's like time just has to work differently because otherwise this franchise makes no sense.
And it works differently. And that difference is that it doesn't make sense.
Right. This is differently. Like I've talked in the past about how there's some franchises that are actual science fiction and other ones that are science fantasy or outright fantasy. And especially by the time you get to the fourth and fifth one, yep. where they're literally in medieval castles and the Transfers have become psychic, telekinetic vampire wizards. This is a fantasy franchise as much as it is a sci-fi franchise. And I don't think it serves you as an audience member to overthink the mechanics very much. And I know the whole point of the show is doing that. So I'm glad we didn't address it here till the very end. But yeah, the time doesn't make sense in this universe at all. And it's only works if you treat it as magic.
Because I can do all the math on time travel physics when it makes sense. But in this case, no, there's no way. That's why I didn't really try to no prize it or create a branch of physics that would make sense of this. It doesn't really, you know, so I don't think it's that kind of movie.
Well, I seriously considered trying to do that, and then I realized that I was putting more effort into the scripts than most of the scripts had put into them. So no, I'm not going to do that. You got to pay me for that.
Yeah, we sort of abandoned
getting back to Harlan Ellison, cross my hand with silver, and I'll give it that much thought. You've seen the other movies in the franchise. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the expanded franchise? Because you seem to have mostly avoided that.
Once you're invested, you're just invested. And it gets more and more bonkers, and I accept the bonkersness of it. I think really, if you're going to just like, you don't have time to watch the whole thing, I would stop before it gets the Army of Darkness. You know, I think the first one,
City of Los Angeles is quite good.
In 88, and then in Transfers 2, Return of Jack Death, and then Death Lives, Transfers 3. I would stop there, probably. There is some joy in seeing Jack Death get back on the horse and have other adventures, even though they're very much divorced from the sort of future noir that was the first film. By that point, I was just watching the character. Another Jack Death adventure, it has no bearing on anything. It's no longer really Trancers, but it's still Jack Death, and I'm enjoying Tim Thomerson playing this character.
Except in the sixth one where you don't get to see Tim Thomerson play the character. Because it's Bela Lugosi's dead by that point. You know, look, Jack Death is Joe Death now. Okay, yeah. Sure. What I will say about the movies, because I did not watch them in order, and some of them I watched sooner and some of them I'll watch later, I pretty much hated every sequel the first time. And having gotten that out of the way, that disappointment in it not being what I wanted it to be, and the failings of each movie, when I go back and I watch them the second time, they're better. Once I'm over it or I'm going into it with lowered expectations, I find that each movie, even the sixth one, is better than I thought that it was and has moments that make it worth my while to give them a watch.
Right. I think if I look at my Letterboxd account, Trancers, I gave 3.5 stars out of 5 and a heart. Okay. None of the other ones got a heart. And all the other ones are like Trancers 2 is a 3, City of Los Angeles is a 3, Death Lives is a 3. And then we get into the fantasy ones. 2.5 on Jack of Swords, 2 on whatever the name of the Sudden Death, which is the fifth one, mm-hmm. and the sixth one is called Life After Death, also a 2. So a 2 is not a good movie. A 2.5 is, it's got its moments, but it's not a good movie. A 3 for me is, I've probably forgotten this within a couple weeks. Like a 3.5 is something I would recommend to people who like this genre. Okay, so that's how those scores work. They never really recapture the beauty of the first Trancers.
I think City of Lost Angels, especially because it's only about 20, 25 minutes, I think it's close enough to the first movie. And the good thing is in the more recent like Blu-rays and the 4K of it, they include the short with the main movie. So if you get that package, you can stop there and be happy. But if you just like dearly love it and you have to go into the sequels, it's your level of commitment. If you're that blown away by the two movies or the 1.25 movie, whatever, you can carry on to the sequels. But since they're free on streaming, you probably want to watch them that way first and maybe even watch it a second time to make sure you want to go any further.
Yeah, I would say that at whatever point you start becoming disappointed with it and you say, oh, it's not going to get better. That's how I'll say it. It's not going to get better. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. So stop when you decide where the line is. Frank, tell the folks where they can find you, what you're working on right now. And you are working on things that we've talked about within the Trancers conversation.
I still do a little blogging. I've got 4 podcasts that I'm getting out consistently. The one that I think would be of the most use to your audience is Terminator Now, where so far I've done 5 months, going on 6, covering the Now Comics adaptation of the Terminator, which is pretty much entirely terrible. And I try to have as much fun with it as I can under those circumstances. But in a couple of months, I'll be getting into the Dark Horse stuff, which people have a lot more affection for. And I'm obviously going to have a more nice things to say about that material. Also, while we have cursed a little bit on the show, I curse a lot on my other shows, and Terminator Now is actually a family-friendly show. It's got proper language, so you can listen to that with whomever you like, which is a rarity for me. So that's probably going to be the way to go if you're Diablo curious.
Or if you've already Diablo adverse because of the language.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That might be the one show that you can watch and stand. Right. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say stand, but like you can listen to it in the car with your kids because your kids want to know all about old Terminator comics.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks again. I will take a short promo break. And when I come back, I'll be discussing your feedback on our previous episode, which was about the Back to the Future franchise.
I'm not a cybernetic organism, but I do have an important mission. Many of you have asked for me to create a podcast. Welcome to Terminator.
No! Celebrating the 40th anniversary of Jim Cameron's Terminator franchise, a sibling show to Dark Horse presents Aliens. Terminator Now will cover the comic book adaptations of the dystopian future sci-fi series.
So we created this for you. If you've seen my movies, I know what you might be thinking, but don't worry. this machine is a good machine. And if it ever turns bad, I will terminate the problem.
So it's me. It's flesh and blood guests. It's text-to-audio robots. Whatever it takes.
So join us. We'll always leave you feeling better.
The show will be featured in our clean language, rolled spine podcasts, four-color feed. So you can listen to stories about murder bots and the post-nuclear apocalypse with the entire family.
Do your future self a favor. Hit the subscribe button today. Come with me if you want to live.
Here then are your comments on the previous episode of On Borrowed Time, in which myself and my guest, AJ Wright, discussed the Back to the Future trilogy. Let's start with Aqua DCD 1969, who says that he listened to the first episode and really enjoyed the discussion. I have also felt that the first Back to the Future is really almost a perfect movie. I particularly enjoyed the time travel and alternate timelines discussion, particularly that you counted them and broke them down for us. Good stuff. Following on that, Chris Franklin says, great first episode. These movies are just so much fun. I love them. My parents love them. And my kids love them. The first is a stone cold classic, and I agree with your estimations of 2 and 3. I rarely rewatch 2. It's the Temple of Doom of Back to the Future. Just a bit too dark and nasty in parts. I like the theory that the altered timeline has caught up with Marty and made him so cocky he can't stand to be called chicken or back down from a challenge. I would agree with AJ that he was always like that, but they hang such a huge lampshade on it in the sequels, it does seem to come kind of out of nowhere in a lot of ways. Is there an in-universe theory out there that Fox Marty erased Stoltz Marty from existence? If not, should there be? I love it. There should be. Chris Pine says, this was a great inaugural episode. I really enjoyed listening to you and Ashford go over this trilogy. It's always fun to hear discussions devoid of cynicism about beloved pop culture content. At that time, I don't think the time travel mechanics mattered, and I would assume that's why people my age probably don't dive too deep looking for flaws with the first film. Back to the Future is one of those universally accepted templates of time travel that set the rules for future films for a lot of the audiences that grew up accepting a DeLorean as a time machine. Was Marty's Never Back Down inspired by his father in 1955, or had he become an entitled rich kid thanks to his family's changed fortunes? Now, he's the Napoleonic Alpha, and no one would dare challenge him, or was it just the writers needed to figure out how to invoke conflict, we may never know. Well, it's definitely the writers, Chris, but look at it from the opposite end. The original timeline might have had a very timid parenting, telling their kids not to overreach, not to make waves, etc., but that's now absent from the updated timeline. Alexander Osias is a fun time travel trilogy that I thoroughly enjoyed. It's fun to hear the rationalizations of the time wave catching up to the time travelers many years after watching many, 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 many more time travel TV shows and movies. Great insights and an impetus to rewatch these movies, perhaps with one of my cousins who loves this set of movies, or with my son who has never seen the flicks. Gosh, I hope you did that. And here's what Diablo Frank had to say in his own voice.
You're nuts with your praising of Back to the Future 3. I saw two of those three movies in the theater, and I remember I was always a big fan of movie reviewers. I read a lot of movie reviews when I was a kid, especially like Entertainment Weekly and the newspaper and stuff like that. And I remember them talking about Back to the Future 3 being like the Brady Bunch go to, you know, camp kind of movie. It's one of those where the franchise has been running to the ground, and they have some novel thing where the family goes to Europe, the family goes to the dude ranch, that kind of thing. And Back to the Future 3 is so that. It's so exhausted by the time you get to that movie. Thematically, it's exhausted. The cast and crew are exhausted. What makes 2 great is the novelty, the fun of seeing the twists on what happened in the first movie, but with the future version. It's not a skateboard, it's a hoverboard, all that kind of stuff. The prediction that of course are wildly inaccurate, the outfits, the self-lacing Nikes, all that stuff is what makes you enjoy the second movie. And I find that a fulfilling experience. It is a little darker. There's a little bit of Empire Strikes Back to that second Back to the Future. But when you get to 3, and the best part is like ZZ Top, you know, showing up to play with the band. I know you got the Jules Verne thing. I know that that's where all the emotional beats are, because they're resolving the story that started in the first movie. Obviously, the first movie is essentially perfect. It's widely regarded as such. I adore that movie as much as anybody. But I still have a lot of affection, and I will stop and watch at least a chunk of Back to the Future 2. I don't don't know if I've watched Back to the Future 3 since the 90s. I think I watched it one time on home video and never touched it again. So to hear you especially just absolutely praising that to the moon and then slagging on 2, I couldn't tolerate it.
All I can say to that is that I had the same feeling rewatching it this year, and that when we did a Back to the Future marathon a couple years ago, everyone shared that opinion at my house, and I'm not sure we can say Part 3 is that much more tired than Part 2 since they were filmed together. So it's either all tired or none of it is. DC Dave says, I'm a huge fan of these movies, enough that I would consider myself someone that you should have at your table if going to a themed trivia night at the local pub. I remember Part 2 coming out Thanksgiving 1989, and I had gotten really sick enough that I was laid up for 2 weeks, and it killed me not to go see it until its third week out. Part 3 I saw on opening night 2 days after I graduated high school in 1990, and the night before I left on an extended summer vacation out of the country. It was my only opportunity to see it. Waiting in line outside my local theater, I was on a date with a good friend's younger sister, and we were set up. Neither of us had an interest in the other. As any good nerd, I was far more invested in the film. I remember spending the last half hour on the edge of my seat. What a great film, and the suspense was incredible. I think my favorite discussion here was the different timelines. I'm going to throw out 2 more potential timelines for your consideration that you left out. Both take place during Part 2. Dystopian 1985, Marty on top of the building being chased by Biff. Marty jumps off the side of the building but lands on the DeLorean hood. 1955, Marty gets rescued by Doc with the DeLorean, which is hovering above, and drops down the banner ribbon it had been caught up on earlier in the film. So how did Doc know to be there at those exact moments? Both times, Marty appears to have zero knowledge that his life is in mortal danger, and both times, Doc arrives in a nick of time to save Marty from a situation where he very clearly would die if Doc is not there. I argue that the first time each event happens, Doc is not there, and Marty does die. And that Doc uses the time machine to figure out what happened, travels to that moment, and saves Marty from certain death. So in each instance, there's a timeline where Marty dies in those moments, but a corrected timeline where Doc saves the day. There seems to be no way for Doc to know this information beforehand unless he just happens to have a time machine and has knowledge of events that have already happened, and then goes back in time to deal with those events with that foreknowledge. Yes, Dave, I think that's quite possible. The one I glossed over rather fast is the one where Marty does not show up in Dystopian 1985, so Lorraine doesn't threaten to leave Biff. It's a very minor change, but there would have been 2 timelines there. Speaking of timelines, Paul Hicks, who is likely my next guest on this show, says, I have a Starlog with an article by Bob Gale, written before the sequels were on the horizon. He definitely subscribes to the multiple timeline theory rather than the rubber time. He explains how the Marty, who started with the successful family, ends the movie stranded in 1985 without plutonium, with the loser family, and Doc dead in the car park. Yes, that's how Doc explains it in Part 2, but doesn't really work with how the films actually present time travel, not entirely anyway, and therefore my own theory. And now Mike Dynas says, you two brought up so many great points about all 3 movies, and I must say, I don't think I ever thought about the time travel elements in these movies that much. To me, while time travel is a central point in these movies, they're more about taking charge of one's life and being proactive to make one's life better. Marty's line at the start of the first film, what if I send in the tape and they don't like it? I mean, what if they say I'm no good? I mean, I just don't think I can take that kind of rejection. That resonated so hard for me as a kid. It's taken me a long time to stand up for myself like Marty finally did, and sometimes my brain still says that line to me. But those emotional beats make me feel like I could do better like Marty. Let's end it there. Cisco Cinema on Borrowed Time is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So if you're listening to this and have your own opinions on what's been discussed, please feel free to head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com to leave a comment. I'll read them on our next episode. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWPodcasts. We're done here, so cut it, print it.